You're listening to CFRU 93.3 in Guelph. This is Tara Michelle, and we are in the studio now with Daniel McIver, who is doing a writer in residence program here at the university, and we're just going to have a little chat. So, welcome. I was asking you off of the air. Can you tell me a little bit more about what the writer in residence program you're doing is?
Well, the writer in residence, I mean, chooses a writer, that would be me, to be in residence. And that would be the Massey building, which is the oldest building on campus. And has lots of character. And so my job is, basically, I'm here, I have office hours twice a week from noon till 7, which is following the bus schedule, basically. And I see students, and I also, there's a component that's open to the community too, people in the community who are interested in writing. And I look at their work, and then I meet with them and I talk to them about questions they might have or impressions that I have about the work. I'm going to be working specifically with a couple of groups of students who are doing collective creations in the theater department, and so I'm going to give my opinion. I keep saying I have opinions. That's really all I have, is I have opinions. I actually spent time with a novelist, and I could just say what I liked because it's not really my thing. No, I read them, but I don't write them. Mm-hmm. And that's basically. And I was also supposed to be writing while I'm here, but I haven't really had time to do that yet.
And is this through the English department, drama department? How did this come about?
It's through SETS is the name of the organization, and it's English and theater together. So it's through I was actually surprised. I thought there'd be a couple of writers, you know, to accommodate all the different kinds of writing, but I am the writer. There's just one, and before me was a poet. So Guelph just has one writer per term.
Okay. How does this mentorship role compare to kind of doing your own solo work? I mean, I think that, you know, playwriting tends to be a very like solitary experience. And then, you know, people become experts in their field and they go into teaching roles and mentorship roles. And it's actually a very different like structural experience. How is that?
Yeah, I've been, there's a thing in theater called dramaturgy, which is basically like story editing in the film world. And I don't really do much of that just because I'm very prescriptive in the way I talk about an idea. In terms of somebody else's writing, I'll basically just say, well, why don't you give it to me and I'll fix it. And then I'm not very good at sitting back. It's a great lesson for me. You know, it's a challenge and for me to let, not to constantly be offering advice, but to listen to what they want. You know, someone told me, I asked one of the instructors, when you have a piece that you don't really know, that doesn't appeal to you, and how do you respond when you speak to the student? And they say, you say, what is it about this piece that interests you? And you start from there. So it's great. It's very different than working in a professional capacity as a theater creator. And I've never taught this. I've never had an employee number before. This is my first actual official employee number, and being part of an institution and people thinking I'm a professor, and you know, so I feel like I'm a bit I'm undercover or something, pretending to be a professor.
That's nice. I wonder, do you direct as well as write?
Yeah.
So I wonder how it will like trickle into your own work and accepting feedback and that
too. It'll certainly, I'm actually been writing about a character in a play that I've got coming up next year. This is an academic. So this is really helpful research.
On the ground research. Nice. I asked also because I had seen the Rhubarb schedule. Rhubarb, for folks who don't know, is a 3-week theater festival that runs of mostly queer, mostly all one act shows, involves lots of installation work and stuff in the last few years as well, Three Buddies in Bad Times Theater. And you know what? I just gave all that preamble. It wasn't a Rhubarb schedule. It was the season schedule for Buddies, though.
Right. But it's good to give a shout out to Rhubarb.
For sure.
Rhubarb is a really important festival.
And Rhubarb is actually one of my favorite theater festivals.
And it's worth the trip to Toronto if you don't live there, because you get five shows in an evening, and really some very traditional kind of theater stuff, mm-hmm. and then off the wall performance. It's a great mix.
And like performance as you're walking between one and the other.
Yeah.
It's totally nice. It's like a little festival within a festival because you get to like not leave the building and decide what you want to go see.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
Have conversations.
And every week is different. Three weeks, and every week is different. It's a great event.
So I was on the Buddies website going to look at the Rhubarb schedule, and I wound up looking at the full season, and a few things came out. But Mark Scheiser, who's a young Toronto playwright who I know has a show coming out, I guess, next month in March, and he got described as a young Daniel MacIver meets somebody. And I was like, oh, I wonder what it is to be at like that, you know, stage of your writing career too, where that's the...
I wish it makes me feel like what happened to the young Daniel MacIver and I turned into the old Daniel MacIver.
I've never seen you build as such.
I was once called a stalwart, and I figured that was the sign where I kind of got old. It's interesting. I mean, I think people have described my work as postmodern, and I'm not even sure that I think that postmodernism was invented by Nike or something. I don't really know for sure that it's a thing. We're so ahead of ourselves. I think we're still in modernism, but we're just so ahead of ourselves. We want to be postmodern, so we call it that. But postmodernism represents, what they call meta theater or self-reflective theater. So theater that acknowledges its artificiality.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, it creates a more authentic experience. So, and I think that's when people do that, they'll sometimes be described as being like me. And it's not like I didn't invent it, mm-hmm. but you know, I did do it a lot.
You are somebody who's working in that form. That makes sense to me. I guess, you know, kind of branching off of having just talked about Buddies a little bit, there is kind of a funding crisis right now that's getting talked about a bit, surprisingly, actually, in the mainstream press, giving some attention to theater funding cuts. And I know that you are doing a benefit for Buddies, and my rumor has it that this is a coming out of having said that you were going to retire from solo
I did. Shows. I retired from solo shows.
I guess not really. What's that all about?
Oh, I'm Cher. I don't know. I think that's
a two-part question. Funding cuts, solo performance.
The thing about the funding cuts is that they actually had to cancel a show a buddy of mine, actually, Ed Roy, had created this show. And
I think Buddy specifically did. They cut two shows that are coming up.
Oh, they cut
season.
Two.
There's the one that was supposed to be coming up right after Rhubarb, that Gay for
the
Pay.
The Gay for Pay, that's Ed Roy's show.
And I think there was one later in the season that also got cut.
Wow. Well, yeah. So they had a shortfall. And so they called me up and asked me if I would do something. They actually asked if I would do Cul-de-Sac, which is the last solo that I did. And as my farewell to performance, I did three shows at Buddies 2 years ago. Or 2007, 2 years now. And I did House Here Lights Henry and Monster, three solos of mine. And then that was supposed to be the end of it. So anyway, we'll get back to that in a second. But I'm doing Cul-de-Sac, which is a solo performance that I had done at Buddies. And that the Buddies people, they liked it and they enjoyed that show a lot. And so they asked me if I would do it. So I'm doing a kind of an unplugged sort of version. I don't know how unplugged it's going to be. They're contacting the designers. I don't know if they actually spoke to the designers yet to see if they're willing to, you know, chip in their time too.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are, then it'll be less unplugged. But if they aren't, then it'll be more unplugged. And I'm going in. I'm going to spend a few hours every day that week working with the text. It's hard to know how much of it will be. I'll have. So it'll be. Kind of working without a net a bit, so that mm-hmm. might be exciting for people. And the thing with the performance, I have done a return to performance that I didn't. I went to, I decided that I was, that maybe it wasn't the healthiest thing in the world to be doing this kind of performance, which was often kind of autobiographical and. I thought, you know, maybe I shouldn't be just making stories up and pretending all the time, and I should go out and have a real life. So I decided to go out and have a real life.
You quit theater school for that reason?
Yeah, but you know what I found out when I went out to have a real life was that everybody is still making up stories and pretending, except they're not admitting it. At least mm-hmm. in the theater, we're admitting that we're making this stuff up. So I had a very kind of nightmarish couple of years where in my real life, which was... that's probably the subject of another whole nother kind of show you would have. But what I did was that I decided to make a solo show about it. So I have a new solo show called This Is What Happens Next. And it's basically, it's to some extent what happened to me in the last couple of years, which involved getting married and not working and all kinds of stuff interesting things happened. And so anyway, the show is basically based on that, and that's the new solo. So I have come out of retirement, and I did that show in Montreal in January in a workshop presentation, and I'm going to be doing it in Toronto in 2010. So cul-de-sac is a way, it's sort of saying, I was just kidding about retiring.
Interesting.
And that's on March 20th, Friday, March 20th at Buddy's, and it's a benefit. And I think the tickets are pricey. The cul-de-sac tickets are pricey because it's a benefit, yeah.
There's lots of different directions I can go in. I want to ask about working in lots of different spheres, and I guess we kind of got into this a little bit when I was asking about mentoring. But, you know, currently working in this academic context versus working in some pretty subversive queer theater contexts and performance art spaces, and then probably more traditional theatrical settings as well. And just kind of, you know, I think that people make a lot of assumptions as to, like, how open-minded or closed-minded or accepting different audiences will be. I want to ask you directly, just talk about different audiences and different areas.
I've often underestimated audiences in terms of what they're willing to take. There have been times, I often will go to a tiny little town in Nova Scotia called Antigonish, where they have a summer festival and try out stuff there. And I've done some pretty urban, or I don't know, I want to say racy, but I think that sounds kind of old fashioned. It's just edgy, kind of edgy, dark things. And a lot of the audience, there's actually a nunnery nearby, and the audience is often made up of nuns. And it's just, but I find that as long as you're trying to, you know, this is a kind of loaded phrase, but as long as you're trying to tell the truth, whatever that means, but as long as you're trying to touch something real or authentic, people are engaged by that. And they're not. And also, I think that because of the nature of my performances, I often go into character. So they feel protected. They don't feel, when I get in their face, it's not me, it's the character. So they can, there's some distance for them. Yeah. And, so I've actually, like I said, I've been mostly surprised by the level at which people, how accepting people are of points of view that may not be theirs. Although the other thing is too that it's surprising to me too that audiences, I think there's something in the United States, when I perform in the United States, there's an idea of a thing called countercultural work. And we don't really have that in Canada, an idea of countercultural art. So there are spaces that program work that is considered countercultural, and they have that kind of audience, and they show up. We don't really have that. And I actually think that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that as Canadians, we tend to be a little more cynical in a good way about what the state is telling us we're supposed to think and feel and be. Whereas in the United States, I think they have been led a bit into this American dream. And so they have to have something countercultural programmed.
Yeah. I think what that counterculture often is like a fairly liberal kind of resistance art too, right? Like where it's, I don't know, to some extent people that you'd, the average person is accessible to the average person, but kind of doing over the top things as opposed to like really coming from a grassroots or whatever. I think that comes up a lot in kind of in my life in poetry spheres of like kind of Americanism as like, you know, like the beatnik culture and that kind of thing. And I don't think that we're missing that. I think we're missing having a bit of structure around it or having a specific space for it maybe, but we're not necessarily missing that form itself. Similar things happen in theater.
It's more integrated somehow in a good way. You know, and that's why you can go to a festival like Rhubarb where you're going to see someone who's aspiring to be Eugene O'Neill and somebody who's aspiring to be Laurie Anderson and someone who's aspiring. You know, there. I mean, you can see all kinds of different sorts of forms of expression in this one festival. And mm-hmm. and I think you see that generally. You go to the Fringe Festival, you do, you know, any of those things, you're going to see such cross. It's like I said, I think we're slightly more integrated.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, too, because I think sometimes I think I'm so inside of like a bubble or like a urban contemporary thing that I forget how kind of risque the classics are to some extent and how big Broadway shows are often pretty sexually explicit, pretty involved, you know, that there are books that make Oprah's list that are pretty inane and there are things that make it quite big that actually have a lot of depth and a lot of things going on as well and have throughout history.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting also your comment about the Nova Scotia. Is it Nova Scotia Festival?
Yeah.
I definitely have heard different artist friends talk about it. I had a friend who did Hedwig in Port Hope.
Right.
And it seemed like the ushers were going to quit. Like it seemed like the staff were like, we don't do that here. But the audience is like, they were receptive. They got it.
Yeah. I think they check generally what the sad thing is that people who run theaters don't really know their audiences that well. And they always, always underestimate them in terms of what they're willing, what they're hungry for. They want something. They don't. I don't think they want to see something that's not. They're not going to go home to. Mm-hmm. They want to see something from somewhere else.
Yeah. I mean, and it makes sense to some extent that people who are booking are worried about safety. That they want to make sure their audience is coming and paying and consistent. And at the same time, like, you know, where do you look at what your audience is actually coming for if you're not providing them with options or providing them with the range? So tell me about what you're working on currently, current projects, future projects.
Currently, I'm working on a trilogy of plays that I'm, for some reason, calling the Hunger Trilogy. I'm not exactly sure why yet, but that's what I'm calling it. And there are three plays. One's called Confession, one's called Communion, and one's called Redemption. And I guess I'm referring, and they're all about a man's search for meaning, a human search for meaning, and I guess that's what our hunger. And one of those, the first play, Confession, I'm doing in Nova Scotia with the theater there, and the second play, Communion, I'm working on with the theater in Toronto, and Redemption, I'm doing at the National Theatre School in Montreal. So those are ongoing in different stages of some early drafts, some in late drafts. And I'm also working on a movie with Bruce McDonald, and it's a... I don't know. I'm supposed to say any of this, but I guess I'll say it because no one told me not to. But it was originally going to be a sequel to Hardcore Logo,
mm-hmm.
which is Bruce's. It's a great. If you haven't seen it, it's such a great movie. It's a great, great rock and roll mockumentary. I was doing a sequel to. He wanted me to write a sequel to that, and it turned out that due to a number of situations, and I'm going to call it schedule because it's mm-hmm. always one of those great words you can use, scheduling problems, we ended up having to go in a different direction with it. And so the two main characters were supposed to be two men, but I'm rewriting it now for two women. So it was two kind of aging rockers who were trying to get their lives together, these two guys, and now it's two women. And and that's been a great change in the story for me because it mm-hmm. turns it it's what I did when I first, the first thing I did when I went back to the draft is I just did a very, I just changed the pronouns and to see how the story would work. Mm-hmm. Just, and of course some things just didn't work, but some things surprisingly did. And so that's been really an interesting process for me. And so that's what I'm working on that. And I'm also working on, I made a movie a few years ago called A Whole New Thing. With a guy named Amnon Bookbinder who teaches screenwriting at York. And we're now working on a second movie together. That one we co-wrote and he directed, and this one we're co-writing and I'm directing, and it's called Eugene, and it's a gay exploitation teen revenge thriller.
That's a range. That's a range you're working at. I feel like the last time, I hope this was you, you're going to be like, that was somebody else. I feel like I saw you read in the summer at... The Writing Outside the Margins Festival.
Yes, yeah.
Does this Tennessee Williams character fit into any of
Any
of these projects?
No, it's another project.
No, different project? Okay.
That's a play called His Greatness. And that's a play that I wrote about a friend of mine back
in... I'm going to back up for one sec to let folks know that the Writing Outside the Margins Festival is a writing festival that kind of takes the model of Word on the Street, which is the big Canadian-wide kind of street festival of writing and... queers it, and has had lots of great people through town, both local and not, in the last couple of
John
years.
John Cameron Mitchell was there.
What's his name was there? James St. James was there.
Oh, James St. James.
That was me
right,
making
right,
powder
right.
face
yeah, James St. James,
with my hands on the radio.
Jeffree Star was there, wasn't he? Was that he?
That was a Pride. The same year, I think. Patrick Califia came into town for
Jeffree
it.
Star punched somebody in the face at Pride, I think.
He got kicked off. I remember that. And Trish Sella was in town last year. And then, you know, local folks from Toronto and surrounding areas have also taken part in that. And it's been nice because it's also a range of, you know, playwrights, novelists, poets. Yeah. Peter Dubé was in town last year for Montreal. Anyhow, that was a little backtrack so folks know the context of outdoor middle of the day.
I was reading from this new play that had just been done in Vancouver called His Greatness. It hasn't been done in Toronto, and we're working. That's in process. We'll see how that goes. But it's a friend of mine in 1981 was a hustler in Vancouver, and now he's an academic, but anyway. But he was...
It's not uncommon.
He was a hustler in Vancouver. And Tennessee Williams was in Vancouver for a premiere of a play of his. It wasn't really a premiere, actually. It was he called it a premiere. He was a bit of a mess. And what he used to do was he'd send his assistant out and pick up a young guy on the street and bring him back to the hotel. And then Tennessee Williams would have the young guy read. And he'd usually have him read from the Bible because it was handy, or sometimes he'd have him read from one of his plays if he was around. And then Williams would basically sit back and laugh at the kid for reading badly and throw things at him. And he was just in such a dark place. So I took that story. I'm a bit more sympathetic to Williams in it. I don't go that he's not quite that dark, but it's about what happens to, you know, what is greatness and what happens to it but I don't actually call him Tennessee Williams in the play. I call him the playwright.
Oh,
just because. But it's so clearly Tennessee Williams. It couldn't possibly be anyone else. But
did you not say that you didn't introduce him as Tennessee Williams?
Probably did.
That was my reference.
No, I did. I'm sure I introduced him as Tennessee Williams, but when I introduced it, but I don't. His name is never.
You could just change the
play.
Accent. It would be a totally different character.
He's talking about his white linen suit and his sister Rose. He doesn't say no. He doesn't name anything. He doesn't name any names or give lines from any plays. But it's pretty clear that that's who it is.
It's the accent. It's not really the accent. I wanted to ask you. I mean, we talked about this, but I'm going to ask you again. I guess about writing subversive material in Canada specifically, and kind of, I don't know, the role of that. Like, what is. I don't know. I'm not going to ask you what is Canadian subversion. That's a essay question.
What are you going to ask? What
are you going to
ask?
That's not what I mean.
What's the essay question? I want to answer the essay question.
The essay question was, what is Canadian subversion? But that's not really what I mean. I guess I just want to ask about, like, what makes your work specifically Canadian, or if it's you. And I think I ask that because you do have a name as a local name.
That's a good question. I think, like I said before, I think as Canadians we tend to be a little more cynical, which I think is just more, which means that we see reality a bit more clearly, mm-hmm. And we don't believe everything we're told. I think that our subversion is our cynicism. I mean, I think that I don't mean, you know, I think that cynicism is incredibly healthy.
And does that mean writing cynical characters or writing for cynical audiences or both?
I think it means both. I think it means approaching the world with a question and also I think that we understand we've been positioned between, you know, the eagle of America and the queen, you know, and here we are in the middle of these two incredibly powerful kinds of icon, one not very iconic and one just powerful in a muscular way, and as we sit there in between these two things, it's hard for me. I mean, I can't talk for our country, but I can say what it feels like to me, and it feels as if we understand that it's not about the answer; it really is about the question. And I think that when you look at Canadian work in comparison to American work. Just generally, not just subversive. I'm just talking about work generally. I think that what the Americans seem to be striving for is answering things, and the Canadians seem to be striving toward questioning things. And then when you take that questioning further and deeper, then you get transgression and subversion. And I think that that's in you know, you look at the most celebrated Canadian playwrights, like someone like Judith Thompson, it's incredibly, and who's here
who
at
also
Guelph.
Teaches here. That's right. Yeah. And it's just, I actually think she teaches at Humber, at Guelph at Humber. I think she teaches.
She has an office here.
Oh, does she?
Next door to me, but she's on sabbatical. But yeah, and she that's incredibly subversive work. Mm-hmm. And but you look at even someone like David French, who now, you know, people think of it that the plays are sort of sentimental or something. But when you look back at those stuff in context, that you look at Of the Fields Lately, a play of his, at the time it was incredibly subversive, and it addressed dysfunction, violence and dysfunction inside family and you know, that was our, in the 70s, when that was our kitchen sink drama, and it was drunken, you know, our version of Leave It to Beaver, you know, if that was, it looks like the Americans kind of Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey Into Night. I mean, I think that we just tend to be, I mean, I don't know, maybe things are different now, because I think that even in the last 5 years, certainly in the last 10 years, we become so you know googly, YouTubey, you know, I don't know if the lines are blurring, I think, in terms of what we're producing and what the Americans are producing. Mm-hmm. And I'd be interested to see in another 5 years where that all lands. Mm-hmm. I don't know what how a 20-year-old feels they are Canadian, and how that's different than being an American, and what subversion even is. Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be the first question, like, what's even being recognized as being, you know, risky in any way at this point.
Yeah.
Like, what, where is the edge?
I mean, it still surprises me that you can kill somebody, but you can't have sex with them on, you know, you can show somebody killing someone, but you can't show somebody having sex with someone. It still seems so ridiculous and strange. Mm-hmm. You know, it just blows my mind that that's still happening, and that that hasn't changed at all.
And it's also the rules that we pay attention to, or they get like good media sensation or whatever. I mean, I think that some of your answer really came back to talking about how you under or overestimate audiences too, and maybe how Canadian work is produced with Canadian audiences in mind. Not to say that a Canadian audience is smarter, but in talking about being used to cynicism I think that there's something to be said for the fact that we have been able to voice our cynicism in a different way, whether that's been heard or not. I don't think there's been the same repercussions that there have been, let's say, in like the southern U.S.
Right.
For voicing kind of dissent. So
there's also, because of the fact that the model in the United States is a commercial model, and we don't have that in terms of theater, say. Mm-hmm. The goal in, you know, in the United States, you make a play and it becomes a commercial success and you buy a house. That's mm-hmm. kind of the way that people look at it. Certainly in New York, and if you are producing work in L.A. or Columbus, Ohio, or wherever, the dream is that it'll go to Broadway or it'll go to New York, and we don't have that here. Mm-hmm. So, and we also, because we have been funded well by the government, and it's up till now, and development is a really important part of the process. I mean, mm-hmm. it's all about development. So I think that the work doesn't have the same qualitative. It's going to sound it, but I'm going to say it doesn't have the same superficial intention or the superficial goals that American work can tend to have because of the commercial thing.
I mean, I think one of the things about theater as a form too is it doesn't have the same commercial market. You can have the biggest theater with the most expensive tickets or whatever, but that's still a really limited audience to some extent, where I think there are other forms that are, you know, buyable and downloadable and tradable and burnable and different, you know, I think, like, I'm thinking about books and movies specifically, where there's, or and music, you know, there's lots of different formats to get it in. And I think that live theater as a form is really specific to its, you know, where it's meant to be, true form.
It's time-based. It's absolutely time-based. And someone once said, and I have to Google this because I keep referencing it. I don't know who said it, but somebody said the purpose of theater is to prepare us for death, which I actually really like that. But
I've heard that.
There's
possibly
something
from you.
there's something about that's because we're dealing in real time, and we're, you know, it's, I don't know if you've had, people have had the experience of going into the theater and seeing, I remember when I saw Angels in America and it was 3 hours long and it felt like 20 minutes. It was so engaging. Mm-hmm. And then I've seen rhubarb shows that were 20 minutes long and felt like 5 hours. Mm-hmm. Time is so elastic and depending on how you engage with something. And time is the essence of what makes us, you know, this is the thing that we lose and the reason we die is time and all that, you know. So I think that the theater has a very particular kind of place in our culture that's very different than, you know, in Montreal, when I work in Montreal, the first time I went to work in Montreal, I noticed that on Saturday nights, it was their low night of the audiences would always dip on Saturday. And in English Canada, it's always Saturday night, your big night. And I asked the box office why there were there were less people. And they said, people go out on Saturday nights for entertainment. And I realized that even in French Canada, there's this slightly different idea around what the theater is. And it's like you would go to, for sort of a spiritual or intellectual edification.
Mm-hmm. That kind of seriousness that's placed onto theater.
Yeah, that it's not, I mean, people are laughing and there's lots of comic, you know, it's not that people are having a good time. Mm-hmm. Sure they are, but they're walking in with a different expectation. And it's not like going to a movie or like going to a bar or like going bowling. It's not in the same.
It was interesting. Last year I was reviewing for Fringe Festival, so I was going to tons of shows and trying to make friends come with me because I had no other time. I was like working evenings and whatever. And the number of people who kind of surprisingly just told me that they didn't like theater, where I was like, you don't go to the theater. Like you don't like the play you were dragged to when you were 10 or, you know, you didn't like Sesame Street on Ice or the classical opera format. Yeah. But when was the last time you went to a small theater or I keep saying small theater as though I'm privileging it. And I, you know, when you mentioned Angels America and when I made that comment about the classics, whatever that is, I think there are really big, worthwhile shows that are high budget, that are intelligent and subversive and all of those things as well. But
I think that that's so true. You know, I think that we think we don't like theater. And I think there's nothing like being in a room with a play that's working and that the audience is engaged with and to be part of that. Mm-hmm. Once you've had that experience, you'll take the chance. And sure, I mean, I don't know that is it a 50-50? Does it work 50% of the time? I don't know. I don't know what the percentage is. It's hit and miss with the theater. You just never know. But the one that works is worth the five that don't. It's such an incredible connection that you feel with the people on the stage and with the people in the room.
So I want to ask a question without answering the question. I don't know how to do that, but I'm just going to answer it internally. I've been really critical of what's being passed off as experimental theater lately, which is because I think I care about experimental theater and formats and shows that happen outside of conventional spaces or outside of conventional I like performance art, and at the same time, I'm kind of gotten to the point where I'm like, no, you're just sort of standing on the staircase like waving a baton, or you are naked and screaming, but you're not really I don't know where the study went into that. I'm wondering what that turn was, or if other people think that this is a good idea. Like, what are your opinions on the current idea of installation as theater? I've seen in the last few Fringes, etc., a couple PowerPoint presentations, a couple stand-up comedy routines, things that were entertaining. But that I really don't believe were theater.
Well, there's
despite them happening in a theater.
There's a couple of things that that happen, and one is that people think a generation thinks it's inventing something, and they're doing what the Rooster Group did. That people bring a table on stage and they wear their street clothes and they think they've reinvented something, and people were doing that before. And so there's a level that can work, but if there's any smugness around it, it's not going to work. If you kind of think you're inventing it, it can be really unpleasant. And I think that the level of the kind of performance installation and that kind of stuff, I think for me, it's always been, it has to have, there's a level of danger in it. There's a level of discomfort that I feel, but not repulsion, but discomfort, mm-hmm. just this kind of a kind of discomfort in a way that I know that it's pushing a button that's an area I probably need to work on. Mm-hmm. You know, not something I want to run away from, but something that just makes me uncomfortable. And that to me is, there's the danger in that. And I don't know what's dangerous anymore. You know, what's you know, back when Karen Finley used to shove yams up her ass, and I saw her do it at the Diamond Club in Toronto years ago, and she was doing that, was her performance, and cover herself in chocolate and roll around. And I mean, but she was so angry. It was, mm-hmm. It was very uncomfortable. And you don't, it's the kind of thing you don't forget. I think
the 90s had a very specific relationship to performance art. Like when you mentioned that, I was thinking about different performances that I've seen that were heavily into raw meat. Right. Like, you know, like I'm trying to think of things that aren't like violence and sex specifically talk about discomfort. And I do think that some of that stuff maybe is dated, like had its place in the way that it was shocking. And I think that, you know, you said Karen Finley, like I think Lydia Lunch, like there are people who were really part of a different era, but I'm not sure what appropriate discomfort looks like now.
I know that's the killing a cat guy. Do you know this guy, the video artist? He killed a cat on video, and it was as art. And people are yelling at the radio because they know I should know his name. You know, that to me is, there's a line there. I can't, you know, I have a big problem with that. That's not acceptable to me.
That to me is somebody being like, the art is over, though. Like that you need to be extreme in a way that's no longer thoughtful. Okay, I think that, you know, what was good about some of these performance artists in their time were that there was all the work that goes into creating any other kind of show, and the kind of background and how you talk about it and how you market it and whatever it is. I think that when you're doing something, I don't know the cat killing guy. I mean, I haven't had a conversation to hear what he has to say.
You Google him and it's all there. It is interesting to consider what is dangerous when without involving, you know, physical threat. I'm sure that I think that what it comes down to me is if the intention is to serve the artist's ego, mm-hmm. or if the intention, and I don't even know if the other intention needs to be stated, as long as it's not that intention. But if it's about serving the ego, we're not going anywhere helpful or interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that initially that's got to be. I think it's, if you want to, you know, start a band and see what you can do. If you just want to look at ego and see what you can do with that. But in terms of performance, if you go to see a band that's just all bravado and ego, there's probably going to be some hooks and some mm-hmm. ability. But if you just see someone sort of swinging something from a staircase, or like waving a baton and screaming on a staircase, and you know,
non-specific. That was non-specific of me.
There's no hook, and where's the hook other than the screaming? But it's a really. That's a very interesting question. And where is Karen Finley and Lydia Lunch now? You know, probably mm-hmm. teaching somewhere.
Probably teaching
at Berkeley or something.
Yeah. So I guess I want to ask you what recommendations outside of yourself do you have? What are you watching these days, reading? What are you?
I'm reading a book by John McGregor called, and I'm going to get the title wrong because it's one of those titles with a lot of words in it, and they could be, but I think it's called If No One Should Speak of Remarkable Things, but it's John McGregor, J-O-N. It's from 2002, and it was a British, it was his first novel. It's an amazing book, very lyrical and poetic and a real comment on England, where England is as a society in 2002, but without yelling that at you. It's gentle in its way about telling you that. And I have a bit of a TV addiction that's really nasty, and I kind of the worst television is the best television, because I feel like the TV is such an evil thing that you just watch Double Shot at Love or something. That's like, that's the best the television has to offer.
I actually, I have a friend, I have to just say, I have a friend who's a prof in Montreal, and she teaches all these kind of sexuality studies and whatever, and I'm always like, you have to watch MTV. Like, this is, it's actually like, it's the end of culture.
Yeah, it's
over,
crazy.
But you actually don't even know how far it's gone. You know, like, it's so post Will and Grace and post, like, I mean, I'm talking specifically in a kind of sexuality realm, but I'm sure it applies across the board to anything else.
But there's also, I mean, it partly comes from, I think this is the first, certainly, this is the first generation where pretty much consistently, almost, well, where a lot of people have grown up watching themselves. You know, this is, people would have a birthday party, and at their 5 year, they're at five, and the first part of the party would be taping the party, and the second part of the party would be watching the party. We've been, and even people are, you know, they're 5 years old and watching themselves when they were an infant. So they're seeing themselves in a way before they were even sentient. And all, our whole idea of our, what, how we were represented and what the camera is, it's changed so radically. And that has a lot to do with that stuff. So I do, and that's why I find reality, whatever the hell that's called.
That's the Facebook theory, too, of people, you know, engaging with their lives to take pictures to post from their car on their way to their next engagement.
It's fascinating. I mean, it's scary, but it's really fascinating. And I find that that's
very modern.
That's what television is doing. And although then there's the other stuff. There is the to me, this is the stuff that's best watched all at once. And I enjoyed 6 Feet Under. Like, it was revelatory to me that, mm-hmm. that you could do that on television, that it could be that engaging. But I would, you know, I watched that as a, I didn't watch that as it ran on the television.
Yeah,
I try, you know, so I've been looking for something like that since then. I tried Dexter.
You should watch Big Love.
That's what I've been it's been recommended, and something about it is just, I haven't touched it yet, but I will, because Dexter kind of disappointed me after season one, and Californication is something I tried, but you know, so I'm very interested in television, mm-hmm. but so that stuff is what takes up some of my thinking, and I don't have a lot of interests outside work, so I don't have a hobby. So
are there playwrights and theater artists that you are that come recommended right now? People you're watching in the theater world?
It's the people that I've always loved that I continue to love. There's a company that works out of Newfoundland called Artistic Fraud, mm-hmm. which is Jillian Kiley and Robert Chafe, and they have a show happening at Factory Theater in Toronto in the spring. Called Fear of Flight, and it's not just because I have a bit in it, because they got Brian McDonald, who's a playwright, he lives in Montreal, and Judith Thompson and Guillermo Verdecchia and a number of different playwrights all contributed. Denise Clark from Calgary, and anyway, so, and Jillian Kiley directs it, and she directs it mathematically. She creates a grid, and they work with a score of with human voices, and it's really interesting stuff. So that's something that's really interesting, and we're going to get a chance to see by traveling to Toronto in the spring. You know, Hannah Moscovich, who people talk a lot about, is that she's a young playwright in Toronto, and she's mm-hmm. the real deal. She's really, really good, and she's got a very interesting...
What's she written? Or...
She wrote a play called East of Berlin that was recently at Tarragon, yeah. and the Russian play. And she has a new play called Post-Democracy, which is really... I've seen readings of it. I haven't heard the whole thing read, but it's very... It's two corporate guys at a conference in a third world, whatever that means, country, and it's really uncomfortable and very, very interesting, and I think it's going to be a great thing when she decides to present it.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I guess I just wanted to ask again, like, if folks are interested in using your writer in residence position here in accessing you for feedback, whatever, is there still space and time to do that?
Absolutely.
And how do people find out about that?
If they just call the theater department and speak to Michael, and he keeps the schedule, and then usually the way that it works is, if you have some work that you want me to look at, that comes with the request, and then we'll you know, I have, because of the number of people, I usually it's about 20 pages is the max that I can take a look at. And preferably, you know, like I said, theater is my field of expertise. I can tell you if I like your novel, but I mean that, you know, whatever that's worth, but theater is the thing that I do understand. And I mean, and also, you know, if people are just interested in starting a theater company or even having a conversation, it's not, you don't have to just come and talk to me about your work. If you have interest in creating theater or making theater in town and you don't know how to go about it or that I'm really interested.
It wasn't my plan when I started this interview, but I'm going to book some time.
Oh, great. Yeah. I think that the DIY thing is a way that that's how we need to make theater here. And I think if we can instigate, I think I say this all the time. I think that we should have theaters like we have 7-Elevens. There should be one on every corner in every neighborhood, you know?
It's like porn theaters.
Yeah.
On one corner. So, Quebecois have you.
You can cross the street and you can go to the porn theater or you can go to the other theater.
Yeah. Okay. That's really not what you were saying. That was me interjecting. So is there anything else you want to give folks as website info, upcoming shows, anything like that?
Yeah, I danielcover.com, and I have a notebook there that I really do try and I go
that
in every
a sophisticated blog.
I go is in every a... I call it a notebook. I'm not gonna call it. It's a blog.
I'm just asking.
But it's a blog. It's a blog. But I do try and keep the conversation to. The process that I'm in, and I don't get into the personal stuff too much. And you know, when my cat died, I did have I put up a South San Gabriel song and gave it a little memorial. But other than that, you know, I try and keep it pretty much to the work. But what I think that what the blog does is just that I think that some people have studied my work in school and they think they might, I don't know what they might imagine that I'm like and or how difficult or easy it is for me, but it's not easy. It's difficult and it's a struggle for me to sometimes stay engaged and to remember what's important, and that mm-hmm. comes up. And so I think that it's good for people to see that I'm working through the same crap that everybody else is working through.
And I don't know this for sure, but I would imagine that your published plays are probably available at Out on the Shelf, or could be, which is the local queer resource library, lending room, reading room, etc. I would be surprised if they didn't have them in, and I'm sure they would get them in or make an effort to. If
more than two people asked, they'd probably get the book in.
I imagine that probably the public library or university library would have some of your published work as well, but I think Out on the Shelf is a great resource to support as well.
So. Ask them if they have I Still Love You, which is five plays, and there's some good queer stuff in there too.
Great. So we've been talking to Daniel McIver, who is currently doing Writer-in-Residence program here at the University of Guelph. And folks can find out more about that by going to danielmciver.com or by looking up the theater department here at the university online and booking an appointment through Michael. So thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks.